B.
While I was preparing this course, my daughter came down at my studio, and I didn't tell her who or what was singing this. I simply put it on and let her listen. And at its conclusion, she shook her head and she said, "Like freaky." Indeed, it is like freaky. The music is freaky, and the voice is a voice the likes of which we are not accustomed to hearing. One word, I would love to tell you who the singer is. But the teaching company is contractually forbidden by the licensing agency we use to reveal the names of the performers on the recordings you're hearing. And that's why I don't stand here on the air and say, this is such and such, and that is so forth and so on. We cannot. But it will be a most interesting experience for all of you to go out and buy all of the male sopranos you can and try to find this guy, because that's a very interesting voice, is it not? This seems to me as good a time as any for us to get into the various classifications of voice types. Any course on opera has got to deal with voice types sooner or later, so let's do it now. And first, just a couple of words about singers, please. Singers, my friends, are not like other musicians, and opera singers are not like other singers. They're a very special breed. The cynic would say, not a happy breed of human being at all, but they are a special breed, and we have to accept them as such. An opera singer, unlike a flute player, unlike a choral singer, is always on stage, is always the soloist, and therefore they are always exposed. Opera singers, by their nature, have to have huge egos. They have to be that batter who wants to be up in the bottom of the ninth with two men on and two men out, ready to hit the ball. This has to be the person that wants it at that moment in front of everyone who could witness their failure if they don't pull it off. For this kind of singer, their body is their instrument. If they have a cold, if they have a sore throat, if stress is doing to their body what stress does to all of ours, it comes out in their singing. They can't hide behind an instrument. Everything that's wrong with them becomes wrong with their music. And like athletes, singers' bodies break down. So there's a limited time that a singer can sing at the top of their game, after which they will teach but remember the glory of those moments, which tends to create a degree of unhappiness, if not bitterness. I would also point out that an opera singer must know how to move and act even while they are singing this extraordinarily difficult repertoire, all from memory. So we're asking them to do a tremendous amount. Can we imagine asking a pianist to play on and off for 4 hours and somehow act and mug and move while they're performing? They'll say, hey, it's enough to press the levers. But not for a singer. It's not enough. Not if you're an opera singer. You've got to be a really good actor, you've got to move well, and you've got to be able to perform the music. Now, you may call me a speciesist, that's fine, but as far as I'm concerned, the most beautiful sound on the planet is the sound of the female human voice. There is nothing as profound to me as a gorgeous voice holding a perfect tone. There's just something about it. It's the immediacy of our own species speaking to us that the voice brings that no other instrument for me can deliver. So let's go through the voice classifications and talk a little bit about vocal quality. Human singing voices, indeed, we're not talking about humpback whales here. Human singing voices are divided into four general categories: soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. Soprano means highest, and indeed a soprano voice, whether owned by a girl, woman, boy, or one of these unfortunate snipped men, is the highest voice classification. Alto means high, and alto is a woman whose voice is pitched below a soprano's, lower than a soprano's. A tenor is a high male voice, and by the way, not always the most pleasant of human beings. I would read a wonderful anecdote which comes to us from the 1880s. The great Wagnerian conductor Klaus von Bülow praised a certain tenor, who charity will keep nameless for now, in front of the critic and writer Henry Krebel. Krebel disagreed vehemently, saying that the singer lacked virility. Von Bülow's response is a classic. But my dear fellow, a tenor isn't a man, it's a disease. A view shared by more than one conductor and producer, I would add. Bass or basso means lowest and refers to the lowest male voice. Now let's talk about these divisions one by one. First, soprano. The very highest soprano is the so-called coloratura soprano, the highest of all soprano voices. Now please, the term coloratura itself only refers to virtuoso singing, not to any particular vocal range. There have been coloratura tenors and coloratura altos and even coloratura basses. However, because of its agility, it is the soprano voice that is most often given a coloratura part. Now, the distinguishing features of a coloratura soprano are as follows. Her range will be up to an octave higher than the other sopranos, so an almost topless upper end. She will typically have a clear, often bell-like vocal quality and incredible agility, for which composers have written some of the most extraordinarily virtuosic music. We just heard in that Vivaldi aria a coloratura voice, but of course it was a coloratura male soprano. Anyway, let's listen to another coloratura aria, shall we? Because this is one of the most famous in the repertoire. This is the Queen of the Night from Mozart's The Magic Flute of 1791. Now, this part was originally sung by Josefa Hofer, who was born Josefa Weber. This is Mozart's sister-in-law. The part of Queen of the Night includes the incredible coloratura aria, Der Hölle Rausch, The Wrath of Hell. Among its many difficulties, the aria features a handful of high Fs. A high F is up here. Now, to squeeze out that sound a whole bunch of times, to leap into that pitch, oh boy. Oh, to step into it is hard enough. And, of course, you are taught by singers who are unhappy with you that if you want me to sing high, I've got to step into it. To leap into a high pitch, you know that's dangerous, my friends. If you miss, you miss, and it sounds terrible. And Mozart has our soprano leaping into those Fs as if they were two octaves lower. In any case, this is where the Queen of the Night shows her true mettle, spitting fire and brimstone. She viciously tells her daughter Pamina that her daughter must kill Sarastro, the priest of the sun. The queen sings this. The wrath of hell within my breast I cherish. Death, desperation, prompt the oath I swore. If by your hand Sarastro does not perish, then as my child I shall know you nevermore. Abandoned be forever, forsaken be forever, and shattered be forever all the force of nature's tie. If not through you Sarastro's life be taken, hark, gods of vengeance, hear a mother's cry. Ho, 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 some mom. Please, let's listen to this as an example of brilliant coloratura writing for the soprano.
Oh,
Yes, there's a classic case of sing at your own risk. Now, the next general dividing line for sopranos is between lyric and dramatic sopranos. A lyric soprano is a typically light voice, a very flexible voice. For example, the voice we heard singing La Musica, the prologue from Monteverdi's Orfeo, was a perfect example of a lyric soprano, a fairly light and flexible soprano voice. Now, a dramatic soprano would be a singer with a heavier, darker, and larger voice. And we talk about a big voice as being simply one that takes up more space than a lyric one. And Electra from Idomeneo, we heard her sing of Orestes and Ajax. There was a little coloratura in there, but that particular singer that we heard was a good example of a dramatic soprano, a very big and powerful soprano voice. Now, the dividing line between lyric and dramatic sopranos is not often clear. Of course, we're talking about small gradations here, and this is very subjective. A voice lying between lyric and dramatic with qualities of both is sometimes called a spinto, S-P-I-N-T-O. Now, lying between the soprano and alto voices is the middle female voice known as the mezzo or mezzo-soprano, mezzo meaning middle. Now, a mezzo has what we would call a very big chest. Excuse me, that's not as bad as it sounds. A singer's chest register is their low register. And what sets a mezzo apart from a regular soprano is that a mezzo will have a big chest. That is, she will be able to get 3, 4, maybe even 5 notes lower than your typical lyric soprano. Many dramatic sopranos have this chest register, and they can sing mezzo parts as well as soprano parts, although generally a singer will sacrifice either their high end or their low end depending on what repertoire they sing and how they practice and train. And believe me, learning to sing is the same kind of training as an athlete would go through. Tremendous physicality, tremendous power involved, and tremendous time spent in practice. So you're usually one or the other by dint of the fact that you need to practice the chest if you want it to be there, and you need to practice the top if you want it to be there, but they are generally exclusive of each other. So a mezzo can approach very near an alto voice, and where a mezzo leaves off and an alto begins is again subjective. For example, in Verdi's day, a voice that he would have considered a mezzo, we would probably simply call an alto. So again, there's a lot of gray area here. It's very subjective. Be she coloratura, lyric, dramatic, spinto, or mezzo, the soprano is generally the diva, my friends, the goddess, the first lady of the theater, the prima donna. And she knows it. Oh, she knows it. Ethan Morden tells us this marvelous anecdote. A soprano on tour in Mexico was captured by bandits who turned out to be music lovers unwilling to molest a daughter of art. They agreed to let her go if she proved that she was indeed the prima donna she claimed to be. "Well, how can I do that?" she asked. "Sing for us," they responded. "What? What? Sing in a cavern? Sing before rabble? Without footlights, makeup, costumes? No lords in the boxes? No critics in the pit? No bouquets hurled at the curtain? No money in the box office?" "Let her go," sighed the bandit chief. "She's a prima donna, all right." All right. The alto or contralto, it's the same thing. The term contralto can either refer to an ordinary alto or a female voice of exceptionally low compass, not unlike the voices of former East German female weightlifters. A countertenor is an exceptionally high male voice singing in the same range as a female alto. Any one of us, my friends, can be a countertenor simply by wearing wet leather boxer shorts and allowing them to dry in the sun. All right, tenors. Like sopranos, tenors are classified as lyric or dramatic, depending on the quality of their voice. A lyric tenor would have a light, clear, flexible voice, and a perfect example of a lyric tenor would be Monteverdi's Orfeo. A dramatic tenor would be one with a bigger, more forceful, and powerful voice, capable of much more volume and much more endurance. Your classic dramatic tenor roles are Otello in Verdi's Otello and Tristan in Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. By the way, the Germans don't call Tristan a dramatic tenor. They call him a heroic tenor, a Helden tenor. But it's the same thing, a very big male voice capable of huge endurance. Otello's first act entrance in Verdi's Otello is one of the most magnificent and dramatic moments in all of opera. He's just survived a vicious storm. He's on board ship. And as he arrives, he triumphantly disembarks and sings of his victory over the Turkish fleet. This is what Otello says at the moment of his entrance. "Rejoice! The Mussulman's pride is buried in the sea. Ours and heaven's is the glory. After our arms, the storm defeated him." And near the end of this brief but moving little aria, Verdi asks our tenor to go up to a high B. That's as high as he gets. Seven notes above a middle C. That is one note short of about the highest you can ask a tenor to go. You don't want to ask a tenor to go higher than this C, because if you do, they could break all kinds of internal organs that they need for various functions. So let's listen to this extraordinary entrance of Otello, and let's be aware, at least in the back of our minds, of how high he gets near the end of this brief aria. Now that's a big voice, and if we compare in our mind's ear that voice to the voice we heard in Monteverdi's Orfeo, we realize that they might both be tenors, but this is a much bigger voice capable of much more power. One more comment about that high C, that, theoretical upper range of the male voice. Another wonderful anecdote. This one features Otto Klemperer, the famous 20th century conductor. And before I tell you the anecdote, I would tell you that many singers mark at rehearsals. That means they sing with half a voice. They save the voice so that they don't give much wear and tear on it. The problem with a singer who marks in rehearsal is you're not quite sure what you're going to hear in performance until the performance, and by then it might be too late to do something about it. In any case, during a rehearsal, Klemperer was screaming at his tenor, who again will remain nameless, "Sing!" And the tenor would not, and Klemperer would say, "Sing!" And the tenor would not, until finally the Klemperer yelled out, "Sing, I tell you, you fool, sing!" So the tenor walked to the edge of the stage and said to Klemperer, "Herr Doctor, I have two high C's left. Do you want to hear them now, or do you want to hear them tonight at the performance?" And that was it. We don't know Klemperer's response, but I imagine he grunted and grumbled and left the tenor alone. One does not have an unlimited number of high C's if you're a tenor, and you must marshal them very carefully. A baritone is a voice lower in range than a tenor and fuller and more heavy in sound. A baritone is to the tenor and bass of the men's voices what a mezzo-soprano is to the soprano and alto of female voices. It's the in-betweeny voice, a little of each. And again, you could have a lyric or a dramatic baritone. We've also heard a baritone in this course. The singer who sang the Mahler "Ging heut Morgen über Svelt" from the Songs of the Wayfarer was a baritone. Lastly, the bass, the lowest male voice, a rich, dark, heavy, and powerful voice, though not a particularly agile voice. The term basso profundo is often used to describe an unusually deep voice. These are the lowest of the singers, and I can assure you, you hear a good basso profundo, they will shiver the timbers under the very seats in which we sit. We've heard a basso profundo. Charon the Boatman from Monteverdi's Orfeo has such a voice. Please, I would refresh your ears of what he sounded like. Give up thy foolish intention. Into my boat will I never admit a bodily being, for the ancient outrages again awaken in my soul bitter memories and just anger. And when he finishes his aria, Charon is singing this note. A low E, very low in the male compass. We can't expect men to get much lower than that. They'll get down to a C, two notes lower than that, and beneath that, everything just starts to fall apart. So these would be the extremes of the ranges, and this is as much as we have time to investigate today. So by no means has this been an inclusive survey of voice types, but we've done as well as we could. We have not discussed, for example, the types of voices conventionally assigned to certain types of roles, because that changes. In Italian opera, tenors are almost always heroes, and basses are either always older men or villains. In Russian opera, it's the other way around. The bass is the heroic voice, and the tenor often the villainous one. Neither have I discussed children's voices, and thankfully, believe me, it's a rare boy soprano who can get within a country mile of the pitch that's been notated on the page. But we've discussed enough about voices that we'd have a common vocabulary, and that's what's important. Now, thus armed, back to our discussion regarding opera seria, the Golden Dark Age, Phase 2, 1700 to 1760. Now, the predictable, dramatically overblown nature of opera seria plots, coupled with the extraordinary liberties and vocal excesses opera singers indulged in, made opera seria a big, fat, juicy, ripe target for satire. And indeed, it was satirized all the time. Perhaps the most famous satire is Marcello's Teatro alla Moda, the fashionable theater, which first appeared in 1720. Marcello's work appears in the form of friendly advice offered to everyone connected with opera, from poets and composers down to stagehands and the singing teachers. Thus, Marcello says to the composer, and now I quote, "We'll hurry or slow down the pace of an aria according to the caprice of the singers, and will conceal the displeasure with which their insolence causes him by the reflection that his reputation, his solvency, and all his interests are in the singer's hands. The director will see that all the best songs go to the prima donna, and if it becomes necessary to shorten the opera, he will never allow her arias to be cut, but rather he will cut entire scenes. If a singer has a scene with another actor whom he is supposed to address when singing an aria, that singer should take care to pay no attention to that other singer, but will bow to the spectators in the loges, smile at the orchestra and the other players, in order that the audience may clearly understand that he is the Signor Alippi Forconi, master of music, and not the Prince Zoroaster, who he is representing on stage. While the introduction of his aria is being played, the singer should walk about the stage, take snuff, complain to his friends that he is in bad voice, that he has a cold, and so forth. And while singing his aria, he shall take care to remember that at the cadences, he may pause as long as he pleases and make runs, decorations, and other ornaments according to his fancy, during which time the leader of the orchestra shall leave his place at the harpsichord, take a pinch of snuff, and wait until it shall please the singer to finish. The singer should take a breath several times before finally coming to a close on a trill, which he will be sure to sing as rapidly as possible from the beginning, without preparing it by placing his voice properly, and all the time using the highest notes of which he is capable. If a singer has a role in a new opera, she will, at the first possible moment, take all her arias, which, in order to save time, she has copied down without the harmonies, to her maestro, so that he may write in the passages variations and beautiful ornaments, and maestro without knowing the first thing about the intentions of the composer, either with regard to tempo or harmony or instrumentation, will write below them in the empty space of the bass staff everything he can think of in the very greatest quantity, so that the virtuosa may be able to sing her song in a different way at every performance. And if her variations have nothing in common with the harmony, or with the violins which are supposed to play in unison with her, or with the other instruments, even if they are not in the same key, that will be of no consequence, since it is understood that the modern opera director is both deaf and dumb. Yes, this is a satire, but my friends, I think it gets very, very, very close to the truth. Audiences, particularly in Italy, looked upon the formulaic, rapidly written, dramatically fatuous opera serie as pure entertainment. And this is a very important point. Contemporary audiences, far from regarding the opera as a serious dramatic spectacle as we might today, looked upon it as amusement. Charles de Brosse reports that the performances in Rome began at 8 or 9 in the evening and lasted till midnight. Everyone of any consequence had a box, which became a social gathering place for friends, like these luxury boxes at the stadiums today. I quote de Brosse, "The pleasure these people take in music and the theater is more evidenced by their presence than by the attention they bestow on the performance," unquote. After the first few times, no one would listen at all, except to a few favorite arias. The boxes were comfortably furnished and lit so that the occupants could indulge in cards and other games. Again, Charles de Brosse. Chess is marvelously well adapted to filling the monotony of the recitatives, and the arias are equally good for interrupting a too serious concentration on chess, unquote. Charles Burney mentions the faro tables at the Milan Opera House. At Venice, where the pit was usually filled with gondoliers and workmen, again to quote Burney, there is a constant noise of people laughing, drinking, joking, while sellers of baked goods and fruit cry their wares aloud from box to box. Get your red hots! Can you imagine at the Opera House? Yeah, it's a very different environment than the one we are accustomed to. Which brings us back to Gluck and his reforms. Christoph Willibald Gluck was born in 1714, and he died in 1787. He was Bohemian by birth, a brilliant composer in the Italian style. He splits his mature career between Paris and Vienna. Now, Gluck's operas are written along the lines of traditional opera seria. His stories are based on ancient history or mythology, and they are grand in scope and scenic scale. But Gluck believed powerfully in telling a good story, and to that end, he used his orchestra much more flexibly and creatively. In particular, he made frequent use of what we call orchestrally accompanied recitatives, recitative accompagnato or recitative stromento, which did much to break up the monotony and the predictability of dry, that is, harpsichord accompanied recitative, followed by orchestrally accompanied aria. Even more importantly, my friends, Gluck simplified his arias in order to make them more emotionally and dramatically direct and to limit the indiscriminate liberties taken by the singers. Gluck wrote this in 1766 in the preface to his opera Alceste. "My intention was to purify music from all the abuses which have crept into Italian opera, through the vanity of the singers and the excessive compliance of the composers, and have made the most splendid and beautiful of all arts the most ridiculous and boring. I tried, therefore, to bring musicians back to the real task of serving the poetry by intensifying the expression of emotion and the appeal of every situation without interrupting the plot or weakening it by excessive ornamentation." Gluck succeeds in doing what Metastasio attempted to do and failed. That is, he succeeded in controlling the singers to the degree that drama starts returning first to his operas, but then to other operas written by other people in the style of Gluck. Now, since the beginning of Lecture 9, we have made a full circle. Monteverdi's Orfeo creates an art form, and Gluck's Orpheus ed Euridice redefines it. Both operas seek, in their own way, to balance words and music, expression, and emotion. Martin Cooper wrote in 1935 about this constant pendulum swing of operatic emphasis on words or music, on excess and reform. And now I quote Martin Cooper. "Opera is constructed of three elements, the musical, the literary, and the spectacular. And at different times, each of these three elements has in fact gained an undue supremacy over the others. For this reason, the history of opera is the history of a series of reformations and counter-reformations, no two countries and no two epochs agreeing on the role of each element and how they should ideally play in the constitution of the whole. Neither evolutionary nor unified, it is the history of perpetually recurring schools of thought, one never victorious over the other, though occasionally gaining the majority of popular opinion." Gluck's operas, as I said before, are the first operas, or the oldest operas, that are still repertoire in the modern opera house. His operas also become the essential models for the next generation of opera composers. And, of course, the greatest opera composer of the next generation is Johann Wolfgang Christian Chrysostomus Gottlieb Mozart, born 1756, died 1791. Mozart's Idomeneo, Re de Creta, Idomeneo, the King of Crete of 1780, is, for my money, the greatest opera seria of the 18th century, and it owes a great debt to Gluck. The libretto, written by Gian Battista Varesco of Salzburg, is one of the old Metastasian types. It's built on a classical subject with amorous intrigues, but it includes within it some choruses in the newer style of Gluck. What makes Idomeneo really work is Mozart, and how Mozart treats these time-honored but no longer useful traditions of opera seria. A few more words about Mozart, and then we will take our break, wholly prepared to deal with Idomeneo. Mozart was one of the few great opera composers who was not an opera specialist. He lived at a very good time and place, because there were many different opera styles popular when Mozart was alive. For example, the old style opera seria, the reform style Italian opera of Gluck, the new comic Italian style called opera buffa, and even the German language opera Singspiel was evolving at this time. Mozart wrote operas, brilliant, superb operas, in all of these extant styles. His first opera was La Finta Semplice, The Pretended Simpleton. It dates from 1768 when he was 12. At the age of 14, he composed his first opera seria, Mithridate, King of Pontus. 2 years later, he wrote another opera seria, Lucio Sulla, which was also produced in Milan. By the way, both of these early opera serie by Mozart were based on libretti by Metastasio. The opera buffa La Finta Giardiniera, The Pretended Gardener, followed in 1775. Mozart would have been 19. The opera seria Il Re Pastore, The Shepherd King, libretto by Metastasio, followed again in 1775. His next opera, Idomeneo, written 5 years later at the age of 24, is Mozart's first great operatic masterwork. When we return, we will talk quickly about the story, the voice character of the main players, and then we will sample a bit of Act Two of Idomeneo so that we can see, A, where good opera seria can go, B, if it's in the hands of someone like Mozart. Thank you very much. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 12, the fourth lecture in a set entitled The Growth of Opera, The Development of Italian Opera Seria, and Mozart's Idomeneo. And that is indeed exactly where we've left off. We've worked our way up through the growth of opera, the development of opera seria, and now we are about to talk about Mozart's E Domineo, a limited discussion, indeed, but enough that we can get an idea why this is such a transcendently good opera compared to so much of the dross that passes for opera seria. So we will call E Domineo opera seria transcendent. Quickly, the outlines of the story. The action takes place in Crete, 10 years after the conclusion of the Trojan War. First, let's talk about the love triangle. We meet Ilia at the very beginning of this opera. Ilia is the daughter of King Priam, king of Troy, who was sent to Crete as a prisoner. On arriving in Crete, Ilia was shipwrecked, and she was rescued in one of those marvelous little serendipitous things that always happen in opera, but rarely in real life. She was rescued by Idamante, the prince and heir to the Cretan throne. Now, despite Ilia's hatred for the Greeks, and she should hate them, they destroyed her homeland, they destroyed her family, they've held her prisoner. Despite her hatred for the Greeks, she has fallen in love with Idamante, which has filled her with tremendous guilt and self-loathing. Ilia is about 19 or 20 years old, and she is a soprano, generally a lyric soprano. Oh, and a point I should make. Singers sometimes have smaller voices versus larger voices. We could say that a certain singer, for example, someone like Maria Callas, a very famous dramatic soprano, and we could say generally everything she's going to sing would be a dramatic soprano voice. However, we could also say that certain roles are lyric roles and certain roles are dramatic roles. The role of Ilia is a lyric role. Mozart reserves some of his most graceful and melodic music for her, whereas for Elektra, some of the most, if you'll excuse me, electrifying and dramatic music. And so the role itself defines the way the singer will sound, not just the inherent qualities of the singer's voice. So the role of Ilia is essentially a lyric soprano role. Idamante, the young prince who rescued her, is about 21 or 22 years old, and his part was originally written for a castrato named Vincenzo del Prato. So Idamante is also a soprano. Elektra is the third member of our love triangle. She's living in Crete and is still grieving for her father and her brother. She is vindictive, hysterical, and as we know, very close to insanity. She is also in love with Idamante. Now, of course, when this piece was originally performed in Munich in 1780, there would not have been a problem figuring out the genders of everyone, despite the fact that all three members of this triangle are sopranos, because the male soprano would simply sound different from the other sopranos. And by the way, if you wanted a male to sound young, that's why you'd have a male soprano. Ideally, this would be a youngish male part. However, on a modern recording, this is going to be a problem, because let's say we have a female soprano singing the part of Idamante, which is common. Who's who on a recording? You don't have the advantage of seeing someone on stage dressed as a man. Instead, we're just listening to three sopranos all singing about how they love each other and blending into each other, and it's hard to keep track. By the way, I should mention, there's such a thing as a trouser role. That's a phrase we hear here and there, trouser role. A trouser role is a part being sung by a woman that was created for a man. So she's wearing trousers when she sings it. Idamante is such a part. If it's sung by a woman today, she'll be dressed as a man. So it's a trouser role. In the recording we're going to listen to, gratefully, Idamante is sung by a tenor, and this will happen as often as not in the opera house today, is that previously soprano, male soprano part will be sung an octave lower by a tenor, and we won't have the gender problems, especially on a recording, that otherwise we would have, and it can be very, very confusing. All right, here's the situation on which the plot of the opera turns. Idomeneo, who is a dramatic tenor, is the king of Crete, and he's shipwrecked on his return from Troy, and like Snake Plissken, everybody thinks he's dead. But Idomeneo is not dead. He's made a bargain with Neptune, promising to sacrifice the first person that he, Idomeneo, sees once he emerges from the surf and steps once again onto his beloved ground of Crete. Idomeneo, I would tell you, is filled with guilt and self-loathing over this dishonorable arrangement. Yeah, I imagine you've all guessed it already. Who's the first person that Idomeneo sees when he emerges from the surf? His own son, Idomante, who comes to comfort this shipwrecked soldier coming out of the water. They haven't seen each other for 20 years, really since Idomante was an infant, so there's no reason why either should recognize each other. When they finally do identify themselves, Idomante attempts to embrace his father. "Dad, Dad, you're alive." Idomeneo, for his part, flees in horror. Like Abraham, he realizes he must sacrifice his own son to appease the gods. Now, Idomante, for his part, is filled with guilt and self-loathing over whatever insult made his father run off from him. Oh, this is Freudian, my friends. Everybody hates themselves in this opera. It's most interesting. All right, Idomeneo dawdles. He doesn't want to have his son killed until finally, halfway through Act Two, he decides to renege entirely on his promise to Neptune. And get this, this is how he figures he's going to get out of the problem. He's going to put Idomante and Electra on a boat back to Electra's home country of Argos, way off in the Greek mainland. He'll spirit him away, and that way Neptune can't do anything to him. Please think about this. He's going to put his son, who Neptune, the god of the sea, wants dead, in a boat on the open sea. Very clever, Idomeneo. That's real thinking. One wonders if Idomeneo left a couple of arrows from his quiver back in Troy. Obviously, this is not going to work, and it doesn't. Now, for her part, Electra is overjoyed. She doesn't know anything, neither does anyone else, about this pact that Idomeneo has made with Neptune. All she knows is that she's going to have Idomante on the proverbial slow boat to Argos. Finally, away from Electra, away from Ilia, and anything can happen on that boat. And she is just filled with joy. She can't wait. She's just virtually quivering. She's so excited. She sings in this aria, and this doesn't sound like the crazed Electra we've already met. The crazed Electra is still in the future when she completely loses out, but now she's filled with sexual and emotional anticipation. "I leave, but will the one object I love and adore, O gods, come with me? Oh, there is not room in my heart for such great joy. Away from my rival, I shall well succeed with cunning and with flattery, so that the fire, which once I could not extinguish, will no longer burn for her, but instead will flame for me. Love that is close at hand will prove stronger than passion at a distance. Love is more effective when one is near the beloved." Yes, indeed, she has every intention of making Idomante fall for her, with Ilia left on Crete, she on boat with Idomante. Anything can, and in her imagination, will happen. Now, we're going to start listening from the very conclusion of this aria, when Electra is singing, "When one is near the beloved, say the chin l'amante cor." And then we're going to continue listening. Here's what will happen immediately as this aria concludes. As Electra reaches her conclusion, we hear a wind, brass, and percussion band playing the next number, a march, in the distance. And then Electra says, "I hear in the distance the sweet sound summoning me to go aboard." So she exits in great haste and great excitement. The band march music, which we've been hearing from the distance, grows louder as the scene changes. We arrive with Electra and the new scene at a busy harbor populated by townsfolk, soldiers, and sailors. Then the band stops and Electra bids farewell to Crete in a dry recitative. "Shores of Sidon, you were the cause of my tears of sorrow and of love. O cruel, inimical place, I leave you finally and bid you my last adieu, my last farewell." Now, this is what we will listen to, and here's what I want you to be aware of. We have an absolutely effortless, seamless segue. I will use that word a lot, segue. I should make sure we all know where it comes from. It comes from the Italian seguire, which means to connect. So a segue is a connection between two otherwise unlike parts. And we talk about segues, we talk about this sort of connection. I want you to notice the effortless, seamless segue from the end of Elektra's aria, overlapping with the march. The march gets louder, the scene changes, the march is continuous, so we've had a continuous bit of music through the scene change, and then her recitative. Non-stop music, everything carefully connected, none of it predictable, no apparent breaks in the musical fabric. Now, immediately following the end of this recitative, we have a choral number. That is, the chorus comes in and sings almost prayerfully the following. The sea is calm, let us go. Everything is reassuring. We shall have good fortune. Now, let us leave quickly. Elektra comes in and sings, sweet breezes, be the only ones to blow. Calm the anger of the north wind. Be kind with your gentle breezes. Spread love everywhere. Is this our Elektra? Yeah, it is. It's when she still thinks she has a chance. And then the chorus comes back in and repeats its opening phrase. The sea is calm. Let us go. Everything is reassuring. We shall have good fortune. Now let us leave quickly. The peaceful calm of the sea is a thinly veiled metaphor for Elektra's own very unaccustomed calm. Now look, this gentle and idyllic music is literally the calm before the storm. It's filled with inspired effects. Sustained flutes create gentle breezes when zephyrs are evoked. We have a kind of rocking triple meter, dun, 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 that's meant to invoke the gentle voyage on a calm and happy sea. After the conclusion of this combination chorus and aria of Elektra, we again have no break between segments. Suddenly, an allegro, which means a fast outburst, accompanies the last line of the chorus. Idomeneo hurries forward and begins a dry recitative. He turns to Idamante, Idomeneo does, and says, "Go, prince." And Idamante responds, "Oh, heavens," because he doesn't want to leave, and he doesn't know why he's being forced to leave, and I have to get on a boat with her. In any case, Idomeneo says, "You linger too long." Well, he thinks if he shoves Idamante on the boat and gets that boat kick-started, that somehow they're just going to avoid old Neptune. Oh, yeah. "Leave now, and let 1,000 of your heroic exploits announce your return and your fame. If you wish to learn the art of ruling, begin by helping the unfortunate and become more worthy of your father and of yourself." Oh, this Idomeneo was a blowhard, isn't he? Become more worthy of your father. The father is not worthy of the son. But that's a different story entirely. Having said all of this, we're nevertheless going to go into a very long goodbye in the trio that follows. But again, I just want to listen to this segment. The chorus, followed with Electra, followed by the chorus again, and then that seamless merge into Idomeneo's dry recitative. By the way, the last chord of the recitative becomes the first chord of the trio that follows. So that will be segued into seamlessly also. Let's listen to this, and then I'm going to start drawing some quick conclusions about the nature of Mozart's opera seria.